Hi, everybody. Can you hear me okay in the back? Doing okay back there? Beautiful. Come on in. We're going to try to pack you in without being unsafe. We may have to close the doors in a minute, but thank you for coming. And we still have some seats right up front here. It's okay, I don't spit. Unlike Tony Campolo, who does. He's a friend, so I can say that. I could try. That would make your life exciting right here. But I will try to withhold. Good afternoon, Urbana. I'm glad you are here. My name is Randy White. I am the director of the Center for Community Transformation at Fresno Pacific Biblical Seminary in Fresno, California. Yeah, I'm still getting used to the cold here, let me tell you. Fresno is hot in so many ways. I mean, like totally, even the birds have to use pot holders before they pull the worms out of the ground and everything. Thank you very much. I was wondering if people were going to get that. Asphalt has a liquid state. Did you know that? We perfected that in Fresno. So we're glad to be here and to have an hour with you to think about what it takes to transform your city. I have been an urban ministry practitioner for the last 20 years and a community developer in the city with the highest rate of concentrated poverty of any large city in the United States. Concentrated poverty is where 40% or more of any neighborhood lives under the federal poverty line. Fresno, California has a higher incidence of those kinds of neighborhoods than any other large city in the U.S. But you know, we also boast the best tri-tip sandwiches in the world, so that makes up for almost all of that. So here's what we're going to do today. As it says in your description, in the best of terms, the individual efforts of churches and agencies to alleviate suffering and to pursue justice in cities, while that is crucial, absolutely crucial, how might believers pursue a strategy that contributes to the long-term transformation of their communities into places of abundance and shalom? That's the question of the day. What's possible when urban ministry meets community development and that meets Christ-centered civic renewal? What might be possible in the community? So we're going to try to talk about the how, the what, the why, and we're going to try to show you where. Let me just mention in the back of your seminar booklet, there are evaluation forms, and those are really crucial so Urbana can learn from all of these, what we do well, what needs to be improved, et cetera. And I'll just encourage you and ask you to fill those out and hand them to the proctor right at the back afterwards. And if you don't want to do that, there's a QR code on the poster at the door. You can scan that with your smartphone and do the evaluation later, but chances are you really won't do that, so we really want you to fill it out now at the end, if at all possible. Well, this is all about finding your place in God's global mission, and I'm asking, could that place be the transformation of your city? Yes, your city, with everything you know to be true about your city. In 1993, my family and I moved to the poorest and the most violent community in our city, a neighborhood at the time that was being called the Devil's Triangle for its violence, its drugs, and its crime. We bought a 100-year-old house that was large enough to have college students live with us and try to seek the peace of the neighborhood together. It was a shock what we found. There was nightly gunfire. There was a daily parade of transient men who appeared at our door asking for help. There was the drama and the chaos of the lives of children in the neighborhood. There were 3 a.m. calls from women that we had met in the neighborhood who were asking for help because their husbands were out of control and beating them. Our child was threatened at a local elementary school from a gang. Our house was literally falling apart. I was nearly killed by a ceiling fan that fell on me as I sat at my desk in one of the rooms There were plumbing problems, electrical problems. There was a flood in the middle of our living room one time, and I came into the house, and there's a waterfall literally in the living room. I thought, all I need here is a Bible and a notebook and a little mossy bank. I could have had a quiet time right there in my own living room. And then Tina's father, my wife's father, was really handy. He would come and help fix things, and it was like his paradise. He loves fixing things, but it was really disconcerting. Every time he would start fixing something, he'd start muttering, oh my, like if we don't fix this right now, the family's going to die. And one time I heard this, oh my, echoing from under the house. It's like, Dave? And there's a hole in my living room floor, and Dave is down there, and I stick my head down there, and he says, Randy, you got to come down here, man. It's way too fragrant. Those are words you don't want to hear, because it turns out nothing we had actually flushed in the first 3 months of living there was going into the sewer. It was just piling up under the floorboards in the house, so it was like the lake from hell down there. All of these things led us to one conclusion. And that is that this project here, this is bigger than us. We don't have what it takes. We don't know how to fix the house well enough. We don't know how to deal with the immense social issues that we see coming to our front door. It's larger than us. And we need to see ourselves as part of a community of God's people dedicated to a more collective form of impact. Collective impact. Don't forget that phrase. A collective impact that is redemptive. And no matter how intentional and well-intended we were, it would take nothing less than a collective form of impact. Now, this incarnational approach, this placing yourself in the midst of the community that you're seeking to reach, is a movement that God has raised up around the country and the world. And we won't understand community assets or needs or the potential for transformation until those things that we're trying to address actually affect our lives. We don't even care about them. I would read about problems in the paper before making this move and then turn to the sports page right after. I mean, it didn't impact my life, but living in the neighborhood, that was impossible. And of course, Dr. John Perkins, the father of Christian community development, has deepened this movement. There are now some 3,000 members, organizations, and individuals in the Christian Community Development Association. An association that if you want to transform your city, you should get in contact with. But the point that we've learned through Dr. Perkins, through our experience there, was that experience matters. And when ministry is done from the inside, then the true needs and assets of the community can be built. An incarnational posture is a crucial component to transforming the city. So when little Bianca stood in my doorway and nearly fainted from hunger, we began to see the price kids pay for the situations their parents are in. Or when my friend Sharon calls and says that she's being pressured to sleep with her landlord or he won't turn the heat on in her house, we begin to understand oppression more deeply and experientially. And then when we see courage in action, we begin to understand potential for change. We have a friend right now who's chosen to work for and live in one of the worst slum apartment complexes in our neighborhood. Now, he's not only living there incarnationally, but he's working for the slumlord. Because for 2 decades, we've tried to confront this slumlord. And after 2 decades of that not working, with all his layers of protection, we decided to plant a little Trojan virus inside that slumlord's place. And so Sergio now lives in the Los Pinos apartments. And he is from the inside trying to, you know, be God's Trojan horse, right? And so Sergio, you know, one of the things he realized is they don't take care of that place and there's no security. So Sergio goes out and he buys his own security outfit. He doesn't work for a security organization, but he buys a uniform and he gets a walkie-talkie, the cheap kind, costs $30, right? And his wife is on the other end. And he walked around that complex and crime fell, calls for service fell by 70% in that complex. By the simple act of masquerading as a security guy, right? Incarnational, really important. When my friend Saul Cruz tried without success to get a church planted in a Mexican barrio, for years he tried and the men would not respond until a mountain collapsed just outside the village and the sewer systems became awash, more sewage. It's another sewage story, right? Comes pouring down the mountainside, and the men of the city rush to the top of the hill where Saul is leading his worship service with mostly women and a small group at that. And they ask him to come help, and he runs down the hill, and they spend all night repairing the sewer system inside this mountainside. They come up the hill in the morning, covered in human feces, covered from head to toe in crap. And he says, I was so glad it was raining, because it washed our body, and it masqueraded my tears at the same time, as the women washed us down. And he said, the men started coming to my church after that, because he saw that there was solidarity. Their issues were my issues. So let me ask you, what's the motivation in all of this? Next slide. And we'll take it to the next slide. Well, the motivation for so many of these people is they saw that the Bible takes the city seriously. The city is a subject of focus in biblical material. So there are 119 cities and 1,200 passages. Whole books of the Bible are organized. Their stories structurally hung on cities. The Apostle Paul had a completely urban strategy. People are motivated because they see this matters to God in the scriptures. But they're also motivated, these incarnational ministers, because they realize that it's not just that the Bible talks about the city. God actually cares about the city. Next slide. And so he weeps over Jerusalem. He expresses his concern over people who live in Nineveh. He cries over Sibma and Heshbon and Eleah, saying, I drenched them with my tears. What does it mean for God to cry so hard that he drenches a city? Obviously, this metaphor, the writer is saying, this matters to God. Can you imagine God's shoulders shaking over grief for what was happening in those cities? What was their motivation? They realized that God cared about the city. Next slide. So what was their motivation? Most of these people realized that they may have had a theology of grace, but they did not have a theology of place. And this is crucial, friends. Geography matters. In the Bible and in history, people are hyphenated by place. You have Jesus of Nazareth, Saul of Tarsus, Joseph of Arimathea. And in history, we have Teresa of Calcutta, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And not only that are people hyphenated by space, by place, but places have meaning in the scriptures. Bethel, house of God, Jerusalem, city of peace or city of God, Nineveh, representing God's mercy now. These have become symbols. So all of this means that an incarnational approach is crucial, and we start there. But now we're going to transition, folks. Now we're going to transition in this seminar, because we can't leave it there. The individual efforts of those practicing incarnational ministry are not enough. They will never be enough. They're a crucial starting place. They are not a universal starting place. They're well motivated and compassionate, but they often stop short of solving the root problems. You know, the old metaphor is they're all about pulling bodies from the river, but too seldom are they ever about going up the river a ways to find out who's throwing the bodies in the river. And so, you know, food pantries and blankets to the homeless, those things are good, but they can lull us into this false sense of satisfaction that we're actually doing something. So I mentioned Sergio in his uniform walking around Los Pinos apartments. So now Sergio has joined up with Tenants Together. This is a national organization that formally and legally confronts landlords. Now he's working for the enemy, right? And now he's going to work with Tenants Together. He's going door to door interviewing all the residents of the slumlords' apartments all throughout our neighborhood. I mean, seriously, he knows his days are numbered. If his employer learns what he's doing, he'll be fired. But this is his great attempt to go beyond the individual efforts he's doing inside his own apartment to actually influence the systemic issues, what the landlord is getting away with. So Jeremiah 29:7 calls us to seek the welfare of the city. Next slide. And what does that mean? Well, at the very least, City transformation starts with prayer. We're called to pray for the welfare of the city by this verse, and especially by the whole passage. And no attempt at bringing shalom to a neighborhood or city can hope to sustain itself without regular, intentional prayer and people praying on a regular basis. And that's why the community of 30 people now who have joined Tina and myself in the Lowell neighborhood, that's its real name, not the Devil's Triangle anymore. No one calls it the Devil's Triangle anymore. That's why 30 people have joined us in Lowell, and every Sunday night, most of us get together, we pray for each other, pray for the neighborhood, and then we eat, and we rotate around all the houses where God has called us to live. But like the incarnational posture, I also need to say prayer by itself is not enough. I know that there are those who believe that the most important work we do is to sit in a room somewhere praying against the spirits that hover over a city. But I will tell you, if that's all we do, somehow those prayers are missing feet. Because God empowers people who do the praying as well, and they become an important part of the process. And so I want to say today, prayer is crucial. It's an essential starting place. It's an essential sustaining effort throughout the whole effort. That's why we do it every Sunday night as a gathered community. But if that's all we're doing, none of what I'm going to tell you about in the last 20 years, I believe, could have happened if we had only left it at the level of prayer. Incarnational posture, prayer, I want you to hear me correctly, absolutely crucial. We wouldn't be doing what we're doing today had it not been for those two postures. But by themselves, they will not work. They are not enough. That passage I'm showing you up there, if you read the entire passage, calls for the people of God to add to their prayers the investment of their life in the city through the establishment of peace and stability in the most basic of ways, through healthy food, through gardens, through housing, through relationships, through active civic engagement. They're encouraged to build houses and marry off their children and invest themselves deeply in seeking the peace and the shalom of the community. I encourage you to read the whole chapter if you haven't had a chance. So while relief and compassion will always be part of the initial response of God's people, what is it that we're looking for? Well, you know, the title of this seminar today is it's all about transformation. And what is transformation? Well, that's all about shalom. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. How will we know if we're achieving shalom in the community? Because shalom is all about access. And when those on the margins in your community have access to the basic blessings of life and dignity, you'll know shalom is growing in your community. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. Next slide, please. So what's shalom all about? Well, shalom is making things the way they ought to be. The way they ought to be for people, that they should be upright and straight. The way things that ought to be, in people, upright and straight. The way things ought to be for people, in other words, that there ought to be enough, that they ought to have a security and abundance, and the way things ought to be between people. But I love Perry Yoder's definition. Shalom's all about making things the way they ought to be from God's perspective. Wolterstorff says it's the well-being and flourishing of all that God has created. Isn't that a beautiful word, flourishing? You know what flourishing means. You know when a child is flourishing and when they're not. Flourishing. Shalom is about flourishing. Sometime read Isaiah 65, which is the new heavens and the new earth passage that talks about this. It's a preview of what will come. And it encourages us to work toward that society that God is preparing for us, where there is housing, where there is good work to do, where there's relationships that people can enjoy, when there's conflict resolution, when there's health for the vulnerable, especially the very old and the very young. Just read Isaiah 65. That is a picture of the shalom community. So a key principle in working for the transformation of your city is to realize that transformation is not a destination, next slide, but it's a course of action. That course of action leads to a few things. And let's look at a few biblical examples. Jeremiah 32 says, "For thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, houses and fields and vineyards shall again be bought in this land." What was happening? Jerusalem was totally surrounded by Babylon. The siege ramps were built up. They knew that they were in their last days. And Jeremiah is in prison. And his cousin, Hanamel, comes to him and says, cousin, would you please buy this piece of land that I don't really want, but could you please buy it? Now, if you're in prison in a city that's about to be taken, you know, by the enemy, are you going to want, is that land going to be worth anything? Jeremiah knows it, and he says, you know, God, what is this all about? And God says, yeah, you need to buy that land. The whole idea behind this is that we're called to value physical place and God's view of it. Because in that passage, he does a very public transfer of title so that everyone will know that houses and fields will again be bought and sold in this land. And Jeremiah, you're going to own a piece of that. This is one of the things we can commit ourselves to then in the transformation of a city, is that place matters. Geography matters. God believes that houses and fields will be bought again. No one thought that about Lowell. One of my neighbors, the folks who've joined us in this effort to reclaim Lowell and from its former identity as the Devil's Triangle, has a little sign in his window. It's a very bright sign, and he lives on a very busy street right in the heart of our neighborhood. And the sign simply says, "This place matters." And it's because everybody in that neighborhood knew that that place didn't matter to the city, didn't matter to the police, didn't matter to anybody. It was always the butt of jokes and stories. But this is Steve's little witness that this place matters, and that's an important message for a neighborhood that for decades knew that it wasn't true. Or Nehemiah 2 says, "You see the trouble we're in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins? Come, let's rebuild the wall." And then 11 chapters later, then the people cast lots to bring out one of 10 to live in the holy city, Jerusalem. Nehemiah gets a call from God to rebuild the city of Jerusalem, and they do it in 54 days. They've got a beautiful wall surrounding the city, but there's nobody inside. And so what did the people of God do? Some of them timidly raised their hand and said, okay, I'll relocate and I'll be part of the rebuilding of the city. And others were sort of volunteered and pushed to go in, and together they became a repopulated center of that city. What would we be learning from this? That we need to imagine a renewed city and then mobilize God's people toward that end. This is a systemic approach to city transformation, to mobilize God's people to revalue what has once been lost. Now, we're nowhere near close to this 10% mark for people who have moved into the Lowell neighborhood to seek its peace. There are some 8,000 people living in this little quarter square mile tract of land. That's pretty dense. 8,000 people living there. And there are 30 or 40 people who've intentionally relocated there. There are quite a few more people who have remained there. These are as crucial as those who've relocated in and are trying to be a presence in the neighborhood for good. But these who are treating the neighborhood intentionally have already made an enormous difference, even though we are nowhere near the 10% mark. 2 Kings 4:7, "I've nothing in the house except for a jar of oil. Elisha said, go outside, borrow vessels from your neighbors, empty vessels and not just a few." The context here is that this widow was married to a prophet and he died, and her creditors came to seize her children as slaves, and she had nothing to pay them with. So she talked to Elisha the prophet, and Elisha said, "What do you have in the house?" And she said, "I have this little oil, that's all." And he said, go to your neighbors, get all of their jars, come back. And you see several things happening here. Number one, God performs a miracle. They start pouring from the jar. That one's full. They're pouring the next one. This jar hasn't diminished. And they fill up all these jars, right? Now, the presence of God and the miracle was there. Leadership from Elisha was there. Faith on the part of the woman and her sons who were doing the filling and the working was there. And what else was there? Neighbors, jars from neighbors, assets in the community. And this is a key principle in the transformation of your city. Do you know what the assets are? What you have to pull from? The people themselves, often those who are poor, are the assets. And God will raise out of the ashes people to rebuild their cities, as we learn from Isaiah 61. And so we're called to use the resources of the community itself in bringing solutions. I just give you three examples. The scriptures are full. These are all transformational actions. So now, how do we approach intentionally the transformation of our cities, knowing these things? We know that it cannot be the efforts, just the individual efforts of churches and agencies. It must be the collective impact of a networked system. And for that, we need to understand how cities are put together. And so, next slide, what are cities? So in our desire to catalyze transformation in our cities, it's key to realize that cities aren't just places. Next slide. Cities are processes, and they're processes involving decay and rebuilding, neglect and revaluing, ethnic enclaves and ethnic dispersions, cycles of political and economic dysfunction and success. They're processes. And that's why short-term fixes don't work and they don't last. I mean, we shouldn't be caught off guard when a church breezes in, fixes a fence, or paints a house and finds that next year it's in disrepair again. It's why I think the church scattered in all the professions of the city can be more effective than the church gathered, because it understands these processes. They're part of them. This is the work that you do in all your professions. You can anticipate them. You can actually mobilize a strategy to deal with them, and we'll talk more on this later. Secondly, cities are controlled networks of banking and education and commerce and ethnic and social affiliations. And once we understand that, the assets of these networks can be mobilized for the good of a neighborhood. And finally, again, cities aren't just places. They are 24-hour catch basins of subgroups of people, of delivery persons, of theater workers, of pilots, of service personnel, and taxi drivers, and migrants, and sex workers, and knife shift janitorial, and a world of invisible people, invisible to people in more daytime-type schedules. By observing, for example, how the growth of AIDS in one African region followed transportation routes, what they discovered was truck drivers had everything to do with the growth of AIDS along those transportation routes. And they fashioned a church outreach to the refueling stations, which is where the intersection of prostitution and truck driving was happening. And the growth of AIDS along those routes began to drop because of a church taking seriously a subgroup of people. All right, so cities are 24-hour catch basins. So someone wanting to catalyze the transformation of their city will want to analyze the forces and the networks and the subgroups of people that make up their city. It's also important to devote ourselves to understanding the city's identity. Next slide. And so let's talk about this a little bit. You know what? I didn't realize this was animated. That is not a good sign right there. Keep going there, my friend. Just get them all up and see what happens. I was really on caffeine that morning. I don't know what happened. Okay, there you go. All right. So a friend of mine, Father Ben Beltran of Smoky Mountain on the squatter settlement in the Philippines, taught me that every city has an identity. And this identity can be summarized by these three terms, Latin terms. So the urbs, for example, what word do we get from that? Yeah, urban. So the urbs is all about the infrastructure of the city. It's where the highways are, freeways, railroad tracks, because those are often lines of demarcation, you know, west side of the city, east side of the city, whatever. The urbs, how is the sanitation handled in this part of the city compared to the wealthy part of the city? So that's the urbs. The anima, what word do you think we get from that? Yes, animation. Oh, you guys are good. Animation, yeah. What is it that moves a city? It's, Beltran says, it's the unconscious universe of the residents. It's their assumptions. It's their beliefs. Sometimes they can't even articulate what the anima is. Some have called it the soul of a city, or the poetry of a city. We'll talk about this. This is why Paul was familiar in his message to those in the Areopagus with the poetry of the Greeks, right? And then the civitas of the city. What word do you think we get from that? Civic, yeah. The civitas of a city has everything to do with the behaviors of a city. So if I asked you, for example, what comes to mind when I say Paris, what would you think of? Eiffel Tower, what are people doing under the Eiffel Tower? No, looking at their iPhones, no. Kissing, of course. Kissing, because Paris is all about romance and art and music, right? If I said Wall Street, what's the civitas of Wall Street? Money, power may be. I said Hollywood. What's the civitas of Hollywood? Fame, maybe? How about storytelling? Okay, here's what I want you to do. I want you to take 2 minutes max. I want you to turn to your neighbor. I want you to tell them the one thing your city is known for. Now, it could be a wrong perception, or it could be the reality. I don't care. But just tell your neighbor, what is the one thing your city is known for? See if you can come up with a civitas of your city in 1 minute. And then switch after 1 minute, and the other person will do it, okay? Okay, sorry, you have to come back. So it's kind of fun, right? And by the way, you could do that with a group of people, a little bit more time, obviously. You could spend like a couple of hours. It's an amazing discussion, and people are really animated to have that discussion. What is the identity of our city? So let me do a little shameless bit of self-promotion here for a sec. Next slide. In one of my books, I put together a list of questions that you could use in a small group to help understand the herbs, the anima, and the civitas of your city. So if you're interested in having that discussion, at least stand at the IVB table, open to that place, and just copy. Okay, so it's okay. I said it was okay. Okay, so you cannot love your city or work for its transformation unless you really know your city. And that's why understanding your city's identity is an important part of that process. It's hugely important. So finally, then, I want to work toward understanding a city's relationships between its institutions. And that's an important thing to do if you're understanding city transformation. So next slide. Every city is a network of relationships. So here you see public, private, nonprofit sectors of the city. And in each of those sectors, you have institutions. So, law enforcement is a public institution. Some schools are public. Then you have businesses. Apartments are public, are private businesses, for example. Nonprofit sector, you have churches and other agencies, et cetera, et cetera. Every one of those institutions has its own kind of relationship with the neighborhood, like Lowell. Can you imagine how the media portrays my neighborhood? That is a private institution portraying my neighborhood in a certain way. Do you imagine how the police related to my neighborhood? We were only ever a problem to them. No one ever worked hard at building a positive relationship with the police until about 20 years ago in our neighborhood. Every one of these institutions has its own relationship with the neighborhood. And by the way, they all have relationships with each other too. Well, one of the things that we've learned you have to do is learn how to network your city's institutions as assets for the benefit of the neighborhood. So let me tell you about CARE Fresno. There's an apartment complex in Fresno. It had a huge high call for service. It wasn't Los Pinos. It was another one. And so we started a ministry called CARE Fresno. And CARE Fresno built a partnership between an apartment owner who knew that there was a problem, the police, who had constant, they would always drive drug dealers out of the apartment, but next month the apartment owner would just rent to another drug dealer. And then the local school and then a local church brought all of those together. The apartment owner identified the gangbanger and the drug dealer in the complex. The police drove them out, set up a dressing station in one of those units, and then had the school donate computers, books to the other unit, and really stock it as a drop-in center. The church donated labor, in other words, volunteers, to come and do an after-school tutoring program. So what do you have there? You have four institutions in three of the sectors collaborating. CARE Fresno's in 13 neighborhoods, and now, once again, like Los Pinos, calls for police service have dropped about 67% in all of those places because kids have things to do in the afternoons. The drugs and the crime has been reduced. A simple collaboration between institutions in the sector. Someone wanting to see transformation in their city could work to unite God's people in each of the sectors and help them realize the knowledge and the skill sets that they're going to need in that sector and that they have in that sector. So what can you do to unite your city for its transformation? I'm going to try to close with this. Four things. The first is research. So next slide. You can do a shalom scan of your city, just looking for signs of hope and signs of need. You can do that on a strip of outdoor territory, in an outdoor mall area, or a neglected part of the city, or in the downtown civic area, or in a neighborhood. You could do a shalom scan, send a group of people and say, Have your eyes wide open. Pray as you walk. What are the signs of hope that you see here? And what are the signs of need? What could we build on in this neighborhood? Secondly, identify resources in those sectors. That takes a little research. Who do we know that's working in the housing department, that loves the Lord, that's always wanted to collaborate with others in other institutions? Again, the people of God scattered are incredibly powerful, but they don't know it because they're not networked. And this is one of the things that we can work toward. You can explore or exegete your city's identity, just like we did with the herbs, the anima, and the civitas. I mean, the Apostle Paul did this. Go to the next slide. Yeah, he engaged the city. He connected with the religious systems in Acts chapter 17, the synagogue. He connected to the economic system. He went to the marketplace in that city, and he connected with the academy, the intelligentsia. He was doing a scan of the city of Athens, learning about its anima, its civitas, and its herbs. Go back again one slide, if you would. So we can focus our energies around hopeful models and unite around what is causing desperation. In our city, gang violence is a huge issue, and so 15 years ago, a white retired pastor began to weep uncontrollably, and he didn't know why. It was right after the LA riots, and the key question was, what would cause people so much grief and despair that they would burn their own neighborhoods? And he couldn't get past that question. He began to weep. And out of that came a ministry to gang members. He'd never met a gang member in his life. Now, 15 years later, they have placed 1,800 young gang men in full-time jobs in Fresno. It was desperation that led to innovation, and I want to go there as well in just a minute. This ministry is called Hope Now for Youth. Next slide. Go ahead, all right, join. Secondly, join what exists to infuse it with new life and energy while honoring those who have been at it for a while. So what are the solid forms of transformation already existing in your city that just need a new infusion of energy and youth and resources? Could your church adopt a ministry for a 3-year commitment and just see what happens? Sometimes there are solid things already in place, and you don't need to reinvent the wheel. You simply need to invigorate it a little bit. But do you know what already exists in your city? This is a larger question than you might think. Once it goes back to the research piece, you won't know what to join until you know what the current status is. And so research is huge. Next slide. Thank you. Finally, innovate. You know, we've got all sorts of innovation that's grown out of desperation. ESA Love Inc. doing medical dental clinics throughout the valley. We now have 13 pastors clusters. These aren't ministerial associations. These are 13 pastors clusters, groups of about 10 churches in a geography around a zip zone, for example. And they gather every month to talk about the projects they could do together. I don't know about you, but I mean, that is completely unusual in a city. These churches are getting together across ethnic lines, across class lines, because you know none of that matters when you're desperate. You understand how crucial unity in the body of Christ is when you've got a crisis on your hands. And 17% of the people in Fresno don't have jobs. That's twice the national average. That's a crisis. We can't afford to get caught in our ethnic enclaves. We can't afford to stay within our denominations. And so in Fresno, we've broken out. 13 pastors clusters taking their city, the geography of their city, seriously. Fresno's problem is really severe, and so that's created a spirit of innovation. So last year I spent a year leading a team of people researching the best practices of churches doing small business development. You know, you got business people in your churches, and they don't want to sing in the choir, and they don't want to teach Sunday school. So what can they do with the knowledge they have about writing business plans and about mentoring younger leaders and about getting together as a group of investors and capitalizing somebody's good idea? They're sitting there wondering what their faith has to do with their skill sets. So we put those all in a book and in another act of shameless self-promotion. Next slide. It's called The Work of Our Hands. These are examples of church-based job creation employment services. It's a biblical basis and next steps any church could take. But I only put that up there, seriously, folks. I only put that up there so you'll see innovation in process, because desperation breeds innovation. A climate of innovation has been created in our city. Has one been created in your city? You need one. And if the leaders in your city do not feel the desperation that exists in every city, then take them to the desperation. Allow them to taste it and to experience it. Well, let me finish with the final one, and that's educate. I encourage you to gather to expose leaders to the pressing issues of your city, and then exchange real-time data and models of what's working, and then mobilize a practical embrace of those issues. That's the three things we do in something called the No Name Fellowship. We didn't want to give it a name. We would think we were doing something. It's too important. We don't want the thing to be the thing, right? We want to mobilize. And so every other month we get together, we bite off an issue, could be concentrated poverty, could be comprehensive immigration reform, could be education, could be other systemic things a city needs at a leadership level to pursue transformation. We expose leaders to that issue, we exchange information about it, and we try to mobilize some form of embrace for the churches that are represented there. And we've done all sorts of things, from preparing for incoming refugee populations, for educational success, pastors' workshops to help congregations deal with families that are ripped apart through deportation. We passed a bond measure for school funds. We did a film project to educate 500 churches on the assets and needs of Fresno's 22 poorest neighborhoods. I mean, some really creative stuff has come out of that process. So let me finish with this then. The question is, can a neighborhood be changed? Can a city be changed? Can I just take you through a list of the changes in the last few years in my neighborhood? It'll be a little bit of a whirlwind, but I'd love to tell you that change is possible, and then we'll take some questions. There are two new neighborhood associations. People now have a voice, one in Spanish and one in English. No one calls our neighborhood the Devil's Triangle anymore. There's a new community center in our neighborhood. There's a community garden now with all 33 plots rented. We see people out there tending them, so you got relationships growing up right alongside the beans and the pumpkins. We got three churches focusing on the neighborhood now. We got three Christian tutoring programs for school kids. We have a Saturday sports club and soccer teams run by Christians. There's a weekly teen outreach with about 100 teens involved. We have 77% of the homes now have smoke detectors. We've done lead abatement and new window installation. We have 40 dilapidated homes now repaired, a dozen new homes constructed by a new Christian Community Development Corporation to turn renters into owners. When once there was gunfire every night, now there is it is rare. There is stellar improvement at Lowell Elementary School. Churches are collaborating to fix up the local park. There are weekly prayer walks. The streets have been repaved. Should I go on? A little bit of heaven has come down to the Lowell neighborhood, and we ought to be cheering hallelujah for where that place was 20 years ago. And that can happen to the city, because guess what? Other neighborhoods in Fresno are wondering, can we do this there? Can what is happening in Lowell happen in other neighborhoods as well? And the city is now using Lowell as its poster child for what can happen in other neighborhoods. So my friends, today I invite you to seek the transformation of your city in your neighborhoods by forming a community that seeks to have a collective impact together. God's people can do this. Here are some resources on the next page that we're happy to have you write down, and my email as well, in case you'd like to contact me. And we have a little bit of time for questions. While people are asking their questions, let me mention to you that we'd like you to have your evaluations, if at all possible. So what is on your mind? I obviously won't be able to, you know, do a whole book on it together today, but I'd love to be able to give an initial answer, and if you want to follow up with a conversation with me later, I'd be happy to. Yeah. The Christian Community Development Association, ccda.org. She's asking the organization I mentioned at the beginning that you all need to get connected to. Someone else. The Christian Community Development Association, and that's ccda.org. Yes.
How have you experienced transformation as a part of the neighborhood you've been in and the things that you've seen God do where you're at?
Oh, gosh, you know, this is why I wrote those books, because my life has utterly been turned upside down. If I came in with this noble idea of the white knight, on his steed, going to save that neighborhood. And I think that's, you know, a lot of us, you know, at the front end. We're well-intended, but suddenly my neighbors were kind of saving me in a lot of ways, you know, saving me from a purely spiritualized understanding of my faith, whereas my neighbors were exercising faith to be able to walk from one side of the neighborhood to the next, or to make it to the end of the month before the money ran out. That was a very tangible form of salvation they were asking for, and I was only talking about what happens after you die. And so God used it to deepen, whoa, could be electrified here. Sorry, water pouring down. God used that to deepen who I am, to broaden my understanding of my faith. And then he just gave me great friendships. You know, all the partners we met in the neighborhood, walked alongside them. They've made me, I think, so much more I could have been on my own. Thank you for asking.
Place have you found discipleship takes in transforming the city, and more so in balancing the fact that you have college students and people coming in from other places, as well as you then having to disciple the people you're bringing in from the city or meeting there?
Well, we try to wear our faith on our sleeve very publicly, but we found that the way people articulate faith inside the neighborhood, indigenous leaders, is a whole different language. And so we need to help people from the outside understand and value that language. And discipleship looks different, feels different, sounds different from the inside. I think it's important that we make investments. All of us are connected to churches that want to go serve somewhere. This is what churches do well. I mean, you know, we love Jesus, and Jesus, you know, is a servant leader. So we like to go where there's an obvious need, and that's not a bad thing in any way. It's just that we have to invest in helping churches do that in a way that actually doesn't bring harm. And so you all know the book, Helping Without Hurting. Brian Fickert's book is really a crucial book to how to train and prepare groups that will come as, you know, servant teams to do it in a way that doesn't deny the dignity of the very people that they're coming to serve. Here and then here, sorry. Go ahead, brother.
Just in a city where there are multiple churches, like literally there are some churches that are around the corner from each other, and they never speak to each other, like how do you begin the process of getting them to talk and actually move past their denominational arguments or against each other?
Yeah, really key question. And so Fresno's churches were as divided as everybody else's churches. You know, there are 500 churches in my city, but 168 are Spanish-speaking. So you think there's any relationship between the Spanish-speaking churches and the English-speaking churches? There wasn't, right? Part of the reason is Spanish-speaking churches are led by bivocational pastors. They're working during the day. They can't come to a pastor's luncheon, those polite affairs that are often so nice. And, you know, it's not a meet and eat and greet kind of thing. So you have to create scenarios that allow people that have very, you know, conflicting kinds of worlds care about something together. And usually it's something that's happening in the community. So it could be AIDS awareness in the African American community. In my city, that's a huge issue. And blacks and whites have come together around that issue because, you know, African American women, fastest growing AIDS population in my city. And so we need partnerships. Desperation can breed partnerships. That's why I say find out where the desperation in your city is, and then find out people of goodwill and bring them together around addressing that issue. That's where reconciliation happens. It doesn't happen by sitting in a room trying to smile at each other and talking about reconciliation. It means embracing something that actually takes both of you to accomplish, because it's too big for any one of you. And then you see each other's gifts, and you create a table at which people can come and sit. The point of the table is not to get to know each other. The point of the table is to deal with this crisis we have in our city. And if we're serious about that crisis, we put our attention there, and we work on that thing, and lo and behold, we start getting along. God brings us together through the process of embracing something that's important to him.
How have you been able to play the political game without losing sight of God?
Well, number one, don't treat it as a game. So I sit on the mayor's community advisory panel in my city. And you realize sometimes your role is to speak truth to power. And so you're to raise your hand when everyone around the table is in agreement with what the mayor wants. And you're to say, now there's another perspective I need to voice here. It's maybe the perspective that won't get heard around this table, But let me share what some of my neighbors from Lowell might think about that idea right there. So it's the willingness to do that, but it's also the ability to speak truth through power. And this is something Christians have been traditionally afraid of. And so when I say speak truth to power, we understand that. That's Nathan saying to the King David, you're in the wrong. But when I say speak truth through power, what does that mean? It means let's take our places, people. Let's become the mayors. Let's become the city council persons. Let's take our place at the table and not treat politics as some dirty game that has to be played where it's automatic that you compromise your values. The mayor in my city right now happens to be probably the most articulate Christ follower I have ever met in my life. Okay, that is saying something. There are people of goodwill serving. There are examples of that all throughout the country. Wilson Good, former mayor of Philadelphia, for example, runs the Amachi program, mentoring program now. Unbelievable people in the right places. So let's align ourselves with them. Let's recognize there's always a temptation to be seduced by power. And so let's be accountable to our communities because they're the ones who are going to tell us whether we're being seduced by power or not. I don't know if that helped, but that's my first take.
I had a question. You were talking about this earlier with learning from your neighbors and not trying to come in and be like, oh, I'm going to fix this. I've struggled with a lot with doing ministry via my church and feeling like the culture of the city, like the hood culture, the things that are actually really good, they don't actually end up rubbing off on us, and we don't feel the change the way I feel some of the folks we minister with rub off on our church culture. So I'm wondering, like, what's the process of saying we're not going to come in here and make the renewing of the neighborhood make it look like a suburb area, but actually say this can actually still look like the city, and there's actually some good aesthetic things that are, I'm speaking specifically from like an inner city America culture, like how can we embrace the different cultures that are there and say, actually, I'm not going to try to paint over the graffiti. Some of this actually looks kind of cool, but the garbage isn't necessarily good.
Yeah.
So how do you?
We would be greatly mistaken if we're trying to make the Lowell neighborhood like some suburban community in North Fresno. First of all, I don't think it's possible. You know, there are characteristics to my neighborhood that middle-class white people will never feel comfortable with. It just isn't what says to them, you know, safety and renewal, right? So I think there's a lot of sort of inbuilt character, deep historical character in the neighborhood that's going to just be the way it is. The thing for us, though, transformation is going to happen. When we first moved in, only 8% of our neighbors owned their own home. So 92% of the people who live in our neighborhood rent, mostly from absentee landlords. Now it's double the home ownership. So we're trying to move it that way. Obviously, we'd love to see 25% in about 5 years, but right now we're about 15% home ownership. But it's interesting, though there's been a lot of rehab, you know, and renters becoming owners, the character of the neighborhood still retains that sort of authentic indigenous, we've been here a long time, and just because now we own our house isn't gonna mean we're gonna paint it some yuppie color. Right? So, I mean, I live in a hugely Mexican neighborhood. It's like 80% Latino. And my neighborhood looks like an Easter egg hunt. I'm serious. The pastels, they would not be my choice, right? But they are the choice of the people who live there. It retains a lot. We do a disservice if we think culture can be so easily changed. And it really runs deep. We have to find ways to honor that. Now, I just don't, I'm tired, but I'm sorry, but I'm tired of seeing cars parked on lawns, right? First of all, what happens to the place for the kids to play with, right? Secondly, that is an indicator of distress in a neighborhood. It's one of the indicators the police actually use, also with the broken windows. I'm sure you've heard of the broken windows survey, right? The broken windows survey, they put cars on a street. They were fine for weeks, but once a window in a couple of the cars had been broken, all of the windows in the cars were broken. And it's because neglect breeds neglect and invites more neglect. So there are things I'd love to see changed about my neighborhood, but they have little to do with middle class values. I know that wasn't even beginning to approach your question, but it's a start. Yes, sir. Oh, I think there was one back there first, yeah.
At what point in your life did you feel God was calling you to help these people? Like, was there ever a situation that made you really open up your eyes and push you to pursue this kind of line?
Yes, and I'm afraid this is going to have to be the last one. And my young friend up here who was going to ask a question, you and I can talk afterwards if you want, because I won't have time. I was in a slum. I was in a slum. I begin a lot of my stories with I was in a slum, because for the last 4 years of my life, I led slum ministry on 5 continents with Baki Graduate University. And so really, truly, most of my stories are I was in a slum when, but I was in Oxford, England. Doing sabbatical. And I met somebody who was working in a slum in Manila, and it all started when we showed each other our photo albums of our families. His photo album showed he was a New Zealander. He showed his 3 very blonde, very blue-eyed children playing in a shanty, squatter settlement, and they were playing with a cardboard box, open sewage running down the middle of a street, adoring Filipino grandparents kind of gathered around, adopted grandparents. Our photo album was the well-edged and trimmed world of suburbia, all the latest electronic toys at Christmas time, adoring grandparents. And they were doing literacy projects, micro-enterprise development. They were doing a church plant, ESL classes, education things. I mean, it was holistic ministry. And I remember looking at Michael and saying, you guys are doing amazing things. This was my, like, Urbana moment. You're doing amazing things. I mean, this incarnational ministry. And he looked at me like he'd heard that question 100 times. And in his New Zealand accent, he said, "Nah, Randy, I just found out where Jesus lived, and I moved in with him." And those words would not leave me alone. I just found out where Jesus lived, and I moved in with him, and they rattled around for the rest of our time in Oxford. I came home. We began experimenting with urban ministry in the Lowell neighborhood downtown. We fell in love with the residents there, and after about 1.5, 2 years, we knew that God was calling us there, and that's a whole lot longer story. And in one final act of shameless self-promotion, you can read about it in the book that was up there. That's a key question. Hopefully this is an Urbana moment for some of you, that God is calling you to seek the transformation of your city, to just do your part and to catalyze something in your city. And I'm happy to sit around and chat, or if you want to connect me by email, I'm happy to talk with you as well. But thank you so much for your attention this afternoon. And please don't forget your evaluations.